Hi, this is Corey Olson, the Tolkien Professor, and welcome to another episode of the Silmarillion Seminar.
Greetings once again. I'm Dave Kale of the Silmarillionaires, and Professor Olson's partner in crime on the Riddles in the Dark podcast, to which I know you're all listening diligently. This episode, we spend an unprecedented third week in a row on the same chapter, namely, of Beren and Luthien, for which I will proudly take credit given my effective delay tactics and lobbying. Thus, I will forever affectionately refer to this episode as One More Week. Another acceptable title, however, would be Huon Singular Sensation. Now, I know this is going to shock our listeners, but we spent at least the first 15 minutes of this episode arguing the merits and dangers of oaths taken in Middle-earth. It's the topic that just won't go away. However, we rapidly move on to Beren and Luthien's assault upon Thangorodrim, and briefly discuss exactly what Tolkien meant when describing Morgoth's lust for Luthien, both the broader notion of desire, as well as the more disturbing sexual overtones. We explore fascinating parallels, how Luthien is variously similar to a Silmaril, to Arwen Evenstar, and to Sam Gamgee? Right around 2 hours, we finally get to discussing the singularly powerful moment in which Luthien moves Mandos to pity for the sorrows of the two kindreds, in which Tolkien takes themes from traditional myths and magnificently deepens them. Oh, and don't worry, we finish where we began. On oaths, of course.
Okay, hello, this is Corey Olson, the Tolkien Professor, and we are hoping that we are broadcasting live. So we're still kind of testing this out here. Our hope is to make my weekly Silmarillion Seminar a weekly live event here on Middle-earth Network Radio. Then let's get going here. We are starting, as you guys recall, we did the fight of, well, the duel between Finrod and Sauron last time, and we talked about the overthrow of Sauron and the escape of Beren. We got as far as just before they met Celegorm and Curufin. So we had some talk about Celegorm and Curufin before, so I wanted to kind of finish that up first and then move on to Beren and Luthien and sort of as they begin the second phase of their relationship. We had the initial phase of their time together, and now we have sort of the second of these three interludes that they're going to get. These second of three times when they are together in the wilderness and in comparative, limited, and or short-term happiness together, and so I want to get to that. But first, let's finish up with Celegorm and Curufin. Let's see, Dave, I know that you had wanted to come back to the Oath of Feanor stuff. I know that you've been picking fights with people on Facebook on this subject and everything. And so I figure, and especially since this connects with the Oath stuff that we talked about previously, I wanted to give you a chance to get on that. So go ahead and lay into Celegorm and Curufin if you like.
Yeah, absolutely. Basically what it boils down to is, we've had various discussions both amongst our Silmarillion air selves and also on your, with other folks and in my status message and stuff. And, I have sort of continued to harp on this point that I think that those guys are, that Celegorm and Curufin are a couple of opportunistic cowards, that if they really meant to keep their oath, they would be besieging Morgoth, or at least riding in there like Fingolfin and getting murdered. You know, they obviously have no chance. what people have pointed out is, oh, well, technically, they never stated how they would go about fulfilling the oath or what their timeline would be and things like that, which I think is kind of a lame excuse. I mean, come on, you know. They said they would, like, they would relentlessly hunt down anyone, whoever it might be, Valar or Demon of Morgoth, whether they, you know, whoever took it, Silmaril, or kept one from them, they would go after him. And I've been saying, like, you know, I think they're kind of a couple of doofuses and cowards. They only seem to really, they only get serious about fulfilling their oath when somebody else happens to say, I think I might go get a Silmaril. So it's sort of like, hey, we're not going to tolerate anybody else having a Silmaril except maybe Morgoth. We'll let him keep them, you know. Right, so right. I feel like their behavior in this chapter confirms that, right, my suspicion. So While there might be reasonable justifications for why they might delay going after Morgoth, you know, the fact that when somebody else decides to go for a Silmaril, they go out of their way to hinder that person and attack them. And then here we see them plotting to, you know, kidnap Luthien, to take over all the, you know, try to wrest control of all the Elven kingdoms in Middle-earth, and then, you know, finally just trying to, like, ride down Beren. I mean, I don't think these guys can be defended anymore. Maybe some of the other Sons of Feanor are slightly more justified, but not these two.
Yeah, and I mean, just to kind of pile on there, I mean, the thing that I would add to that, I think you could go even further than calling them cowards. Especially when, you know, when Finrod makes his public declaration in Nargothrond that he's going to that he, because of his oath, he's going to support Beren and he's going to help him pursue and get a Silmaril, and immediately, you know, Celegorm and Curafin jump up and invoke their oath. But the way that they invoke, like the purpose for which they invoke it, has nothing to do with the original intention of that oath. You know, they tell him, like, you can't go, you can't take a Silmaril, but they, their reaction is not to say, because the Silmarils are ours and we're going to get it. They have no intention of going after it. In fact, what they do is prevent anybody in Nargothrond from helping to go get the Silmaril. So, in fact, they are absolutely undermining the let's go take the Silmarils away from Morgoth campaign. So this is not like, okay, you're going after a Silmaril, that's cool, we've been waiting for somebody to go after a Silmaril, because, you know, we're like, you know, oath-bound to get the Silmarils and stuff, so I'm glad you're going after, but I'm telling you, once we get it, remember, it's mine, not yours. Like, that's not the conversation they're having here. Instead, they're actually getting in the way of rescuing a Silmaril, and that sort of look that they exchange at the end, you know, when they're sort of smugly realizing that they can move in on Nargothrond here and essentially usurp the kingdom of Nargothrond when Finrod goes away, and that they can essentially try to set him up for death by sending him off with as few supporters as possible. I think they're being worse than cowards there. They're actually essentially trying to exploit their oath in order to gain their own ambitious ends, which have absolutely nothing to do with getting a Silmaril. Or any of the Silmarils. And so that, I think, that to me is sort of the biggest, piece of evidence here, that this oath is not, you know, it's like, Finrod is bound by an oath too, but he keeps his oath even at his own cost, whereas they are exploiting their oath for their own gain. It's just, not to mention the fact that their oath is much, much shadier to begin with, as we talked about before. Let's see. I think Chris, you had your hand raised too, and then I think Brandon wants to disagree with us. So, Chris, go ahead.
Okay, I'm sorry. I wasn't hooked up properly.
No problem.
First of all, I am not going to defend them by any means, but I had just a little bit different take on it than Dave's, although it's a little bit more like yours, Corey. Opportunists and ambitious are the things that come to mind, and maybe cowardice, but they, as long as there's no viable plan to actually take the Silmarils, they love the status quo. I think they are having very serious thoughts about the oath they took, or second thoughts about the oath they took, and as long as there's no viable opportunity to go after it, they're just fine and dandy, having things the way they are, spreading their influence, and in this case, spreading their poison in Nargothrond. But I took it a bit less cowardice than opportunist. I think that's the better word. And then again, ambition to spread their influence.
Yeah. And kudos to good old Celebrimbor, for actually separating himself, from his dad at this point. One of the grandsons of Feanor makes good here, and of course we'll learn a lot more about Celebrimbor, in the Third Age. He's the guy who makes the Elven Rings eventually, but this is the moment where he separates himself. And I think it's especially Chris, go ahead.
I was just going to say, which is what we've learned about Elvish culture, which obviously isn't really much. You see that that's a huge deal for Celebrimbor to separate himself from his family. So just not for this chapter, really, but just a thought that came to me.
No, I agree. I mean, the only place we've seen something like that before is with Maeglin, basically, who abandons his dad. But that one is kind of exceptional and not so very positive, of course. That is, his dad is kind of twisted, so, you know, leaving his dad is not the worst thing he ever did, but the fact that the only other person we've seen do this is Maeglin, whom, as we've seen, is kind of crooked, you know, I think, just basically, Chris, I'm agreeing with you, that it does show that this is kind of a big deal and not, it seems, to be done lightly. Of course, you could say that the Sons of Finarfin, who didn't go back to Valinor with him, and instead went with their cousins, the Sons of Fingolfin, instead, might be said to have left their father, but it's not the same thing. He doesn't repudiate, they don't repudiate their father, which is...
Yeah, they just take separate paths. I think it's very different than, you know, say, Dad, I'm not part of you anymore, go away, I don't want to be with you, versus just saying, okay, I'm going to go on this trek while you stay home. I think it's a fairly different perspective.
Yeah, and even Maeglin, when push comes to shove, that is, when Eol pursues them into Gondolin and is making his speeches in front of the throne of Turgon, as we looked at several weeks ago, even there, Maeglin doesn't openly repudiate his father. He doesn't reply. Remember, this one of those wonderfully terse little Tolkien sentences, and Maeglin answered nothing, right? He just remains silent. Whereas Celebrimbor here makes the much, it appears, and we don't get any speeches, we don't get quotations from him, but he appears to make the much more active statement of actually rejecting his father and distancing himself from him. I agree. I think that that's really a pretty big deal. But, Brandon, you wanted to disagree with me and Dave piling onto him?
No, I don't really want to disagree as much as I want to just kind of add, like, it's a little more complex of an issue, I think. Mm-hmm. I think it's a little more, you know, morally nuanced than how we're making it. Because when you swear an oath, are you not humbling yourself, your own desires, your own egoic desires, to a traditional thing? It's not that oaths are bad, it's just that the elves behind the oaths might be bad. And I always think of, like, of Lewis's preface to Paradise Lost, where he's talking about the pageantry of medieval courts, and where one wears, you know, gold and scarlet, not to show how great they are, but how great the ritual is. And it seems that so is the same with oaths. And I don't know, just maybe thoughts on that?
No, I mean, that seems right to some extent. Certainly, you know, you talk about the elf behind the oath rather than the oath itself, and certainly, the motivations behind the oaths, you know, I mean, it's a big deal, you know, as to whether or not you can get, whether or not you get a good outcome does depend, at least in part, on the motivations behind it at first. I mean, Feanor's oath, its motivation is jealous in the old sense. It's proud. It's arrogant. It's not good. Whereas somebody like Finrod's oath, that oath is motivated by really good things. But I still think, I mean, the thing that we said last week or the week before, I forget exactly when we were talking about this, about the fact of that there seems to be some kind of presumption, at the very least, I hate to use the word because it seems like a strong word, but at the very least, foolishness, and at the worst, presumption, behind the kinds of claims about the future, or sort of implicit claims about the future, that an oath makes. And the problem that oaths seem to get people in is that these situations arise that they didn't foresee, and they're trapped by this confident oath that they made before. That certainly, Finrod himself describes them all as being ensnared in their oaths. So clearly that's a kind of, questionable thing. Well, it's kind of questionable. At least it sort of suggests that maybe not making that kind of an oath would have been better. But Brandon, I do agree with what you're saying. I mean, I don't think that it's necessary. I don't think we should say oath making always evil, but it does seem to, lead to trouble.
I'm going to jump in.
Sure.
Fair enough.
I'm determined to have the last word on this subject. And then we should probably swiftly move on if there's any chance of ever finishing Baron and Luthien. But
True.
I think I would agree that oath-making is not always bad, although I think it's always risky. I think that's indisputable. I don't think how could you possibly say that the oaths that people are making in the Silmarillion are not risky? They're always risky because you can't predict the future. This particular oath, however, is bad. This is a bad oath. There's no way you could possibly defend this oath as good when they sit there and they say that we're going to pursue to the ends of the earth anyone that gets their hands on one of these things. This was an oath made out of hatred, out of greed, out of pride. Like I take issue with the idea that oaths inherently involve humbling oneself and are naturally sort of an act of humility. This oath, when Feanor was standing there making this oath, clearly not an act of humility. This was not, he in no way was humbling himself. Indeed, he was staking a claim to something and denying that anyone else might have a claim. And in the end, I think this was proven. When they finally do get their hands on Silmarils, they can't possess them anymore. They've lost the right to possess them, which I think demonstrates that the oath itself, and it's certainly the people making it, but even the oath itself was, in this case, a bad oath.
Yeah, well, and again, I think the motivation there is really clear. I mean, I kind of, I think that the Oath of Feanor is just about the clearest example that we get of a bad oath. I mean, there isn't any two ways about that. I mean, the narrator states that explicitly, calling it an oath which none should take. So yeah, I think that's sort of our clearest illustration, and can therefore serve as a kind of touchstone to go back to when we see other people's oaths. But Dave, you're right. We do need to push on. But before we push on, two things quick. John, I know you had been wanting to talk about Huon, so I wanted to give you an opportunity to do that if you could. Are you able to get to your mic here, John?
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Go ahead.
Good, perfect. Just a little Palantir problems, almost. Lady Arunase can attest to that. Yes. I would like to discuss primarily how Huon's character up to this point has basically at least served Purufin relatively faithfully, even when, of course, the decisions were wrong, and then finally sides with Luthien. And here we actually see a real open rebellion to the point of its total action against Purufin. Now, earlier, the whole conception of beasts in Tolkien's works is kind of very interesting. I mean, in The Hobbit, we see the Lord of the Eagles and so on and so on. But in the Silmarillion, I think besides Thorondor, Huon basically characterizes this very interesting subsect of kindred, of race, which is not apparent as easily, to the quick read in the Song of the Ainur, and especially in this one specific section, exactly. It's a very small summary. I think I read once in one book that the events in the Silmarillion, especially in Beren and Luthien, are far more of a summary at certain points rather than a full tale, because of course we had the Lay of Lathion, which described it in greater detail. But to basically cap and not to ramble, I found the dynamic interesting at this point, where it seems like now Luthien seems to be the leader, or Beren as master of Huon, rather than the other way around. At the end of this little episode, I think we see Beren taking the knife Angrist from basically the Sons of Feanor.
Yes.
And also, we basically see him taking their horses. So I just wanted your opinion on those two things.
Yeah, I mean, I think I you're certainly right about Huon, and I think it's a really important thing to point to. We have this sort of nebulous category, which we started talking about way back in the Aule and Yavanna, section. There's sort of this slightly nebulous category of being that is creatures who are not children of Iluvatar, that is not men or elves or dwarves, the stepchildren of Iluvatar, but yet who are also not explicitly Ainur either, that is, creatures like the elves. And we talked about that because the elves are discussed by Manwë and Yavanna back in that chapter. And it seems like there are some other spirits coming in, but it's not completely clear. We'll have the dragons too. It won't be too long before we meet Glaurung, father of dragons, and that sort of, that will come up again there. And Huon is again another example of someone who is an animal, he's a hound, and yet clearly has, you know, more than usual canine gifts here, and seems to be some kind of immortal spirit as well, but yet in dog form. So I think that definitely there is a sort of a different category. I was just rereading the Book of Lost Tales version of the Tale of Tenuviel, the first version that Tolkien wrote of the Beren and Lúthien story, and that element of it is much more pronounced in Tolkien's initial versions of the story. That is, instead of the Sauron character, the one who takes Beren captive and holds him captive from which Lúthien much less impressively rescues him, is a cat spirit. His name is Tevildo, Prince of Cats. And basically you just have essentially this sort of army of cats, you know, this idea that the leaders of this one species of animals, namely cats, have sworn allegiance to Morgoth. And you have these other spirits, or these other animals, dogs, who, some of whom have sworn allegiance to Morgoth, and from them, Morgoth perverted them into the wolves, and Karkaroth is the greatest of those. And then, but some of the dogs have remained faithful to the Valar, and Huon is the head of those. So that's where Huon originally comes from. He's in the original story. But there, he's the leader of the good dogs, who comes to Lúthien's aid, especially because she's going after the leader of the evil cats, who are the natural rivals of Huon the Hound. Tevildo the cat spirit and Huon the dog spirit are like, well, I mean, like cats and dogs. They're bitter enemies. So I think it's very interesting that although Tevildo, Prince of Cats, does not survive in the later versions of the story, Huon the Hound does. And John, exactly where you started from, I think is what makes, one of the things that I find that makes Huon so compelling, that is his loyalty at the beginning and, you know, sort of where he starts not as just this kind of free agent, which is what he is in the Book of Lost Tales version. Lúthien just meets him wandering in the woods, kind of doing his own, like, I am chief of the good dogs thing, whereas here he is a hound who follows at the heels of his master Celegorm. He was a gift from Orome, as we talked about before. So I think that, you know, that seeing Huon being placed not as this kind of free agent, but in this clear moral relationship, that is, his choices are moral choices from the beginning. We see him being faithful to his master, and then we see him making the correct moral choice and rejecting Celegorm, his previous master, when Celegorm is really kind of turning, turning even more than usual to the dark side. So I do think that these things really make Huon a far more nuanced character, and a far greater character. He really rises in stature too. And interestingly, last week we talked a lot about the prophecies about Huon, and there are no prophecies about him at all, in the Book of Lost Tales version. In fact, it's not even him who kills Karkaroth, at the end. So I think he is a really interesting character, but I do think that this really sort of adds a lot to him. Before we leave this behind, Laura, I wanted to go to you too, if you are available, because, you made a couple great points, especially the first one about Angrist the knife, is something that I was thinking too. I think it's a really wonderful point, so I didn't want to steal your thunder there, and I wanted you to go ahead and do it. Are you available?
I sure am.
All right.
Yeah, in just a long list of, how people coincidentally get the one weapon that'll work for them in a situation. If it hadn't been for Celegorm and Curufin attacking Beren and Lúthien, Beren would never have gotten Angrist, mm-hmm. which is the only knife that can cut knife. And I forget the simile, like butter or something like that. And that's what he needs to cut the Silmaril out of Morgoth's crown. So Celegorm and Curufin actually did them a little bit of a favor there by allowing Beren to get his hands on Angrist.
Yeah, yeah, no, I agree, and I think that this is a wonderful example of the thing that Iluvatar said way back in the Ainur Lindaway, that, you know, evil things will always bring about good, and they will always end up contributing to the whole, and that this act of malice, just sheer, plain, spiteful malice on Kelegorman Kurofin's part, when they meet, you know, what we were discussing before was primarily their actions back in Nargothrond. Here, I think it's really hard to argue that what they're doing is just out of spite. And yet, their malice, this attempt at, you know, almost unapologetic evil, like, you know, now we're just, we're not only conspiring to take over realms, which, if evil, at least has a certain amount of, you know, guts to it. Now we're just like trying to randomly murder people in the woods. But anyway, in this moment, they end up providing Beren and Luthien with, as you say, with a key instrument that they need to accomplish their task. Ironically, it's the knife of one of the sons of Feanor, which does in fact cut the Silmaril from Morgoth's crown. So all they end up doing is contributing to the thing which they were ostensibly trying to prevent, which was, of course, Beren getting his hands on a Silmaril. So yeah, I think that that's a really neat point. Laura, you also mentioned, I'll just kind of mention it in passing because I thought it was a really neat point. You're right to point to the parallel, between Luthien healing Beren with an herb that Huon finds. It does sound a lot like Frodo's wound, right? And Aragorn finding the Athelas and helping to heal him in the wilderness. And of course Elrond is a direct descendant from Luthien. So I think that we can see that sort of, that healing power being pointed to very early on. And it's another one of the many, many places in the Silmarillion where we can see sort of, I was going to say echoes of the Lord of the Rings, but really where in most of the cases, the Lord of the Rings is really being an echo of the Silmarillion. And I would just also say in passing, this would be one of many parallels between Beren and Frodo. Beren who loses his hand and Frodo who only loses a finger. There are a lot of ways in which Beren and Frodo are actually kind of drawn together, though that's a study for another time. Frodo's a smaller version. But anyway, let's move on to Beren and Luthien. And Luthien's declaration that she's going to stay with him, Beren's decision, his attempt on a couple of occasions to leave her benevolently, to leave her behind. What does anybody want to contribute about that? I see there are a few comments. I know, actually, since we were just mentioning Frodo, Elizabeth, would you like to jump in with the parallel that you wanted to make there?
Yeah, sure. Actually, I had been thinking about the decisions that Beren and Luthien made, and I had been struck by the quote that Luthien had said about to Beren that you must choose, Beren, between these two, to relinquish the quest of your oath and to seek a life of wandering upon the face of the earth, or to hold to your word and challenge the power of the darkness of its throne. But on either road I shall go with you, and our doom shall be alike. And that made me think about the Council of Elrond and Elrond's words to Frodo about the quest of the ring. And that kind of took me on this whole journey of the similarities between Frodo and Sam and Beren and Luthien and both their each individual quests and their relationships with each other. And the more I kind of thought about it, the more I was struck by all of the similarities between the two. And it was just really interesting to me that they both went on these quests where they had to sort of invade the domain of the Dark Lords. They both had these companions who kind of insisted on going with them. They both, it was kind of emphasized how they both had to freely choose the quest, although one had to kind of recover a treasure and one had to lose a treasure, so to speak.
Right,
And then they both had companions who vowed to stay with them out of love, even though the it was really two different types of love. And then they both had these moments where they tried to leave their companions behind out of a desire to keep them safe. Frodo at Parth Galen, and then Luthien here in what we just read, but neither of them were able to do that. They were both pursued by their companions.
Right.
And then they both sort of had this moment of realization that they kind of had this doom of traveling with this person. In the Silmarillion, on 179, the quote is, it says, "Then Beren perceived that Luthien could not be divided from the doom that lay upon them both, and he sought no longer to dissuade her." And then, it's actually very similar in The Lord of the Rings.
Yes.
When Sam catches up with Frodo, it says, "So all my plan is spoilt," said Frodo. "It is no good trying to escape you. But I'm glad, Sam. I cannot tell you how glad. Come along. It is plain that we were meant to go together." So I thought that was really interesting. And then, of course, as we discussed before, they were both held captive in a tower, although Frodo was at the very top of the tower and Beren was at the very bottom. But they were both located by their sort of companion through the whole issue with the song. And then Sam saved Frodo by invading the tower from within, but Luthien saved Beren by destroying the tower from without.
Yep.
So
yep.
I thought that was interesting.
Yeah.
And then also they both sort of entered the respective Dark Lord's domains in disguise, Beren and Luthien as a wolf and a bat, and then Frodo and Sam disguised as orcs. And then, as you mentioned just a minute ago, they both lost a body part, I guess, in their quest. Frodo, of course, a Fram, and Beren a hand, and then they were remembered in song, Frodo the Nine-Fingered and then Beren one hand. And then kind of at the very end, at the end of their successful quest, they both received these special graces that Frodo got to go to Valinor. And then Beren, of course, went to the halls of Mandos and Valinor, but then he got to come back. And the result of that is that Frodo left his special companion, Sam, forever, but Beren got to return to his and stay with his. So I just kind of had fun kind of thinking about all those parallels.
Yeah, no, that is awesome. I mean, you're right. You're right. I mean, this is, that was perfect. Those exactly are, several of the things that I was just alluding to about the ways in which the, Frodo and Beren are paralleled and Sam and Luthien several times. I've got almost nothing to add there. The one thing that I would add is just to sort of emphasize, as you said, the thing that the two pairs have in common is love and self-sacrifice and devotion to each other. With Frodo and Sam, one of the things always to come back, especially that moment, when Frodo tries to leave him behind at Parth Galen and Sam catches up with him and Frodo makes the speech that you read about his plan being spoilt, but it seems that they were meant to go together. And of course we should be remembering, back to book one of The Fellowship of the Ring when they meet Gildor and the elves. And, the elves are advising him that you should, take those that are willing. Don't go alone. That there is strength. That one of the things that, evil creatures are almost always alone, because they can't trust each other and their ends are ultimately selfish. Remember Gandalf to Saruman, only one hand at a time can wield the one, of course, that it would be the One Ring, that is the one made by evil, whereas the good guys make three rings so that they can work together. Good guys are always collaborating, and the bad guys are always working independently and stabbing each other in the back. And certainly Frodo and Sam's relationship and Beren and Luthien's relationship, are two examples of ones which people who are bound together by love and by self-sacrifice, putting one before the other, the kind of ways in which they sacrifice each other. Beren has just thrown his body in front of an arrow for Luthien, and now she is not reciprocating in the sense that she's only doing it because he did that, but now she is showing the same kind of thing, showing, look, I am giving up my life for you. I recognize you're giving me the opportunity to go back and live safely at home, but I am not going to do that. I will go into darkness with you. And both of them, I think, both of them do that. Both of them make that choice, insisting on going into darkness, with the other one. So yeah, I think these are the reasons that I love reading the Silmarillion. when I do this in class, this is why I love reading the Silmarillion first, before we study the Lord of the Rings, and why I'm glad we've been doing the Silmarillion seminar now. I plan to go on and do a Lord of the Rings seminar afterwards, but I, I'm really glad that we've done the Silmarillion first, because this is the kind of stuff that you see. You know, you begin to perceive these whole new dimensions. When you can put some of these moments, in Frodo and Sam's journey in the context of this larger ancient epic quest of Beren and Lúthien, it really just sort of brings things out and emphasizes stuff that one wouldn't just sort of notice by itself. One other point, of course, quickly that I would make is Sam himself draws this connection as well. When they're on the stairs of Cirith Ungol, it's Sam who explicitly recalls the quest of Beren and Lúthien and notes the similarities. He's like, "Hey, you know what? You've got a piece of that Silmaril right there in that glass that you have. We're in the same story still." Sam recognizes. So yeah, I think that's a pretty big deal. Great work, Elizabeth. That was fantastic. I want to talk about the song that Beren sings. And I've been kind of waiting to do this for 2 weeks now, ever since I made my sort of slightly more cynical observation about Beren. I'll start with actually going back to that. The passage I'm thinking about that we talked about 2 weeks ago was when Beren speaks before Thingol. When he's brought before Thingol and Thingol is mocking him and has just asked the question, "Can you show reason why my power should not be laid on you in heavy punishment for your insolence and folly?" Which is sort of a weighted question. And Beren's response, is, and I'll read it again. This is on page 166. "My fate, O king, led me hither, through perils such as few even of the elves would dare. And here I have found what I sought not indeed, but finding I would possess forever. For it is above all gold and silver, and beyond all jewels. Neither rock nor steel, nor the fires of Morgoth, nor all the powers of the elf kingdoms shall keep me from the treasure that I desire. For Lúthien, your daughter, is the fairest of all the children of the world." And, the point I was making a couple weeks ago was that this sounds pretty sketchy, actually. That Beren's first speech is kind of not all that impressive. On the one hand, he's speaking of Lúthien as if she were an object. That is, you know, he talks about his desire for, you know, "but finding I would possess forever." That's not so great. And then he proceeds to sound like Feanor. "Neither rock nor steel nor the fires of Morgoth nor all the powers of the elf kingdom shall keep me from the treasure that I desire." That sounds almost exactly like Feanor and his son. So, you know, Beren's frame of mind wasn't really obviously good here at the beginning, or at least not completely good. There seemed to be some reason to be a little concerned about his own pride and his own possessiveness and his own attitude here. And at the time, I said, okay, let's wait and see what happens later on. And this is the moment, I think. You know, so coming back now, page 178, the song that he sings, which he believes to be a song of farewell. You know, what he says, as he believes he is leaving Lúthien behind forever, or at least fears that he's leaving Lúthien behind forever, here's what he sings. I might as well read this. "Farewell, sweet earth and northern sky, forever blessed, since here did lie, and here with lissom limbs did run, beneath the moon, beneath the sun, Lúthien Tenuviel, more fair than mortal tongue can tell. Though all to ruin fell the world, and were dissolved and backward hurled, unmade into the old abyss, yet were its making good for this, the dusk, the dawn, the earth, the sea, that Lúthien for a time should be." Okay. Now, thoughts on the poem? Who wants to do some reading of this poem with me here? I'm going to see it. Joe, I think you had some ideas here before. Raise your hand if you want to pitch in on the poem. If not, I can go off on it. I can talk about this for a while, but I want to give you a chance before I steal everybody's thunder. Joe, go ahead.
All right. Well, I'll jump in here then. Now, just one thing I want to talk about is, like, I mean, just you really see the tones change, and just like his frame of mind, like you mentioned. I mean, at first, you know, Beren speaking to Thingol, he's speaking of living and possessing things forever. You know, he says, "Neither rock nor steel, nor the fires of Morgoth, nor all the powers of the elf kingdom shall keep me from the..." You know, I mean, he's speaking as one that's, like, positive and certain of life. I mean, like, you know, nothing's going to stop him. And then, you know, when you get to the song, it's just, it's completely switched. He's saying, you know, things in, like, a past tense, like, it's already over. Like, he has no hope whatsoever, like you already mentioned. I mean, he says goodbye to the earth and the sky, and he, like you said, he says, though all to ruin fell the world, and were dissolved and backworld hurled, unmade into the old abyss, yet were its making good for this, the dusk, the dawn, the earth, the sea, that Luthien for a time should be. I mean, he's just speaking as if he knows it'll end, and he's probably going to be hindered by some things, but it's just, it's all worth it. I mean, it just, simply because of her, it's just a... Yeah, it's just amazing how his tone switches and how his perspective is completely switched.
Yeah, exactly. All for her. One of the things that was most kind of disturbing about that previous speech, if you read it by itself, is that he seems to be marginalizing her. He seems to be objectifying. It's all about him, right? I desire this, and I would possess this, and nobody shall prevent me from obtaining and possessing this thing over there that I want. It was all about him and not about her. And she was just a treasure. Now, what he's saying here is almost exactly the opposite, that it's all about her. In fact, not only is all of what he does and want to do about her, he's talking like everything is all about her. Chris, go ahead.
Okay. When I was reading, particularly the very last, three or four lines, it's almost a similar theme to what was heard before, but let me just read these couple lines. Yet were its making good for this, the dark, the dawn, the earth, the sea, that Luthien for a time should be. I finally found the section that I was looking at when the Valar were discussing good and evil, or the existence of evil, and that on page 98, let's see who says this. I think it's Manway says, "Yet evil be good to have been." Like, anyway, it just seemed like
yes. It's
more. It's hopeful. It's even though the world may end, or I think earlier they were talking about the deeds of Fëanor. Even though all this great evil can happen, to take notice. More importantly, of the hope of the good things that result, even though the bad things may happen along the way. See, it struck me as the very same thing.
Yes, and here, Beren is identifying Luthien with sort of that essential good. You know, that the beauty that Iluvatar has put into the world, the beauty of Iluvatar's creation, cannot be ultimately and finally marred by any evil or by any action. And so Beren there in the second half of the poem, I said this, the second half, he's got two sentences, right? In sentence number two, which is the last six lines, he's saying basically if you could have what would be like the ultimate evil, right? That is the complete unmaking of all creation, the final marring of everything. If everything in the entire world were dissolved and hurled backward, unmade into the abyss, so you're literally undoing creation. Yet, the making of the world, the temporary and now unmade making of the world, would be good that Luthien for a time should be. That Luthien's existence, even just brief existence for a time, would have justified everything and would have sort of undone all of the attempts of evil. So yeah, I do agree. It does seem that even Beren is sort of thinking in terms of sort of that ultimate, all things working for good, that he's kind of embodying Luthien as the expression of that. Brandon, go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say that it seems like here we have a passage where it's like no longer is Beren wanting Luthien for himself, but it's almost more about the entirety of the whole of Arda. And even, like you said, you know, despite the ruin, there was a Luthien. You know, it's almost like this big redemption. She's like this, you know, bright star amongst this great cloud of darkness, you know? And I think therein lies the secret to the answer from the release of bondage, but we'll come back to that maybe a full circle later, I guess.
Yeah, definitely. That's where I want to end up tonight. Yeah, definitely. Laura, go ahead.
Just contrasting a little bit his earlier speech to Thingol and this poem, the earlier speech seems more like something, you know, a guy would say to another guy, sort of boastful and showing, you know, how strong he is and, you know, he's powerful. And this is a much more personal statement. I mean, he doesn't think anyone can hear him, or he's not thinking that someone is hearing him. And so he's, you know, this is much more of an internal feeling or speech, much more emotional and much more something on the inside rather than this outward show that he's originally had given to Thingol.
Yeah, no, I agree, yes. Baron, the rugged Baron, alone in the wilderness, free to show his sensitive side, right? But no, you're right, because certainly, I mean, we have to remember the context of that first statement. You know, he's speaking pridefully, and he's sort of boasting of himself, but he's defending himself too. I mean, he's been challenged by Thingol, and you know, Thingol, and he's been insulted by Thingol. So he's been kind of put into that position to sort of, you know, where he felt he had to defend himself. And here, you know, he is not thinking about himself at all, and that clearly makes a big difference. One thing I'd want to say before we move on from the poem is just more on the we've been focusing mostly on sentence number two that is on the second six lines, and I just want to say a thing about the first six lines. I think it's especially interesting the way that he starts, "Farewell, sweet earth and northern sky." Sweet earth, okay, like, you know, sure, the earth is sweet, but, you know, that earth isn't sweet. Remember, they're on the borders of Anfauglith, the gasping dust. You know, they've just left, you know, the tall Ingarahoth that Sauron filled with horror. They're not in nice places. They're in a section of the earth which has now been pretty thoroughly corrupted by Melkor, especially since the Daigor Bragalach, which just happened in the previous chapter, the Battle of Sudden Flame. So the first thing he starts off by saying, before he gets sort of much more theological there in the second half, he starts off by saying that basically she has cleansed it now. Now that earth is sweet, and the northern sky, that sky which is constantly darkened by the gloom and shadows that are thrown up around Angband, now it's forever blessed. Since here did lie, and here with lissom limbs did run, beneath the moon, beneath the sun, Luthien Tenuvio. She, by her presence, has sort of re-sanctified it. And I think that that's going to be an interesting thing, too, to remember when we come back to the Silmaril and we think about the sort of the blessing of the Silmaril and things being clean and unclean, as we will see later on in this chapter. And so I think it's interesting to remember this moment where Beren has sort of declared the northern world cleansed by Luthien's very presence, which I think is pretty cool. One brief note: a couple of you had asked sort of a more simple question of definition. Wolf, Hame, and Bat Fell; those are basically like the pelts, the coats that they've apparently skinned Draugluin and Thorin Gwethil, and they bring their pelts in order to basically use. But it's not just like, and you know, now we have like a wolf skin hanging over us, but rather it's sort of used, and then through Luthien's power, they are therefore disguised and made actually to look like Thorin Gwethil the vampire and Draugluin the wolf. I would say, in passing, by the way, vampire almost certainly means vampire bat. We should not be thinking Dracula. We should be thinking enormous bat. I don't think I know any examples in any of Tolkien's writings where he uses the word vampire to mean anything but a bat. And especially in some of his earlier writings, bats played a much larger part. In fact, in some of his early stories, orcs not only ride on wolves, they also rode on bats. So they had these like huge bats. There used to be orc bat riders as well as orc wolf riders. And by the time we get to his published stuff, that is to The Hobbit and to The Lord of the Rings, the bat riders have fallen away. Though the wolf riders, of course, remain. Anyway, my point is there's precedent for bats of that size, and it's almost certain that Thúrin Gwethil is an evil bat spirit, sort of parallel to Draugluin, the evil wolf spirit. That's just a quick definition and explanation. I know people sometimes get excited about the whole vampire idea in Tolkien there, but this is not Dracula. This is not Twilight. This is a very unsparkly bat that we're talking about here. Anyway, okay, let us move on to Angband here, and I want to especially look at sort of the three encounters. First, the encounter with Karkaroth at the gate, then the encounter with Morgoth, and then the encounter with Karkaroth at the gate again, the second time on the way out. Let's see, Mike, you had made a comment in our notes about sort of the parallels between Karkaroth and the Witch King, the Lord of the Nazgul's flying steed, and you were certainly right to make that connection. So go ahead. Did you want to talk about that?
Sure. Just very briefly, the language that describes how the sort of dog character or killer dog is nourished and made to grow huge and destructive, parallel the language where there's a little descriptive passage on how the flying steed of the Lord of the Nazgul was made to grow bigger and more terrible and worse than it could have possibly have grown on its own. So a neat parallel there.
Yeah, no, exactly. There's very much a... I always think of those two passages together too. There's a great similarity between how they are fed with fell meats and grow to, you know, far beyond the stature that is normal to their race and are fed. And of course, the implication here in both cases, whether it's Sauron doing it with the fell flying beast or Morgoth doing it with Karkaroth, in both cases, it's not just, you know, that he's being nurtured and fed evil meats. I'm not sure what makes a meat evil, by the way, exactly. Does that mean the meat of an evil creature or a meat acquired in some evil way? I've never been 100% sure about that. But anyway, it's not just like his diet and exercise regimen, but rather, you know, the very sort of power and spirit of Morgoth and Sauron themselves that we know when we've talked a little bit before about how these evil characters kind of disperse their own spirit in investing their servants with evil. And we get in those passages a kind of glimpse of those two guys doing that, you know, sort of that in action, in these moments as they are sort of nurturing, and bringing up these two abominable creatures. And I say abominable carefully, that is, they are made into abominations, deliberately. Good. Now let's see, who was it who wanted to, I'm sort of going through my notes here, about her Luthien felling. Mike, I think it was you again. Her pity for Karkaroth being sort of instrumental in putting him to sleep the first time?
Pity is a theme in Tolkien's works and the power of pity and pity ruling the fate of many. And I just thought that what initially sort of gets the better of this terrible, twisted, abused, violent creature is Luthien's pity, and she says, "Oh, woe begotten spirit, fall into dark oblivion, forget for a while that, you know, the dreadful doom of your life." And her pity is so powerful that the compassion in that pity strikes him like a lightning bolt. And so it's described as something that is just completely overwhelming and overpowering, and probably the only thing that might have been able to completely overpower this creature instantly and completely.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think that's, it's, It's really remarkable. I mean, on the one hand, we can see here the kind of thing that we saw last time when we were looking at the duel between Finrod and Sauron, that is the connection between words and power and songs and power, that, you know, when these things are spoken with power, the things happen. So on the one hand, she's just giving a command. Fall now into dark oblivion and forget for a while the dreadful doom of life. And he's like, okay, you know, snooze. So on the one hand, she says it and it happens. But I mean, Mike, I think that your observation is a really important one, because it is, I think, very important and very remarkable that she is expressing this in pity. She's not speaking down to Karkaroth. She's not saying, like, you know, since you are evil and horrible, you must do what I say. Woe begotten spirit. You know, you are conceived in woe. And what she gives him is, what she does is an act of mercy. That this might be the time when he is asleep, under Luthien's spell, may be the only moment of peace, you know, the only time of peace that he has ever known, because what it means to be invested with the spirit of Morgoth and the way that he has to be made into the red maw and the jaws of thirst. The jaws of thirst, you think about that. I mean, on the one hand, of course, obviously that means he's thirsting, you know, bloodthirsty, right? I mean, his jaws thirst for the blood of his victims and whatever. But of course, it also points to his own suffering, right? I mean, he's continually thirsty and his thirst can never be satisfied. And of course we see this being literalized later on when he's continually thirsty because he's got the Silmaril burning his belly up from the inside and he's trying to slake his thirst at the stream, which he very, very briefly does, but then it doesn't, you know, but of course only temporarily, can he ease the pain from the fire of the Silmaril. But again, that's just sort of the final step of the state that he's already in. You know, he's the jaws of thirst. That's his name. And so she's freeing him from that. It is an act of mercy. Forget for a while the dreadful doom of life. He is under a doom too. He is under a fate too. And his fate is dreadful. His life is dreadful. He is, you know, born to be, bred to be, raised to be, just a weapon in the hand of Morgoth, and his life is horrible and miserable. And that is what, and sort of that's the tone and spirit of how she strikes him down. I mean, Luthien, at this point, from what Luthien has already done, you know, putting the wolf to sleep at the front door, even the wolf, capital T, capital W, to sleep at the front door doesn't sound as impressive. I mean, she's already overcome Sauron. She's already blasted apart the tower. You know, she's already done things which seem even more impressive than this. So I think kind of paying attention, Mike, as you say, to like the tone, and spirit of her speech there, of her moment, is therefore, I think, then especially powerful. Well, let's now go on to her encounter with Morgoth. And there are so many things to be looking at here. In fact, I think that we should start off by reading some here. Just because I think we should. Okay, so I will read the two paragraphs actually right after "As though lightning had smitten him," where Mike stopped there. Okay. "Then Beren and Luthien went through the gate and down the labyrinthine stairs, and together wrought the greatest deed that has been dared by elves or men, for they came to the seat of Morgoth in his nethermost hall, that was upheld by horror, lit by fire, and filled with weapons of death and torment. There Beren slunk in wolf's form beneath his throne, but Luthien was stripped of her disguise by the will of Morgoth, and he bent his gaze upon her. She was not daunted by his eyes, and she named her own name, and offered her service to sing before him after the manner of a minstrel. Then Morgoth, looking upon her beauty, conceived in his thought an evil lust, and a design more dark than any that had yet come into his heart since he fled from Valinor. Thus he was beguiled by his own malice, for he watched her, leaving her free for a while, and taking secret pleasure in his thought. Then suddenly she eluded his sight, and out of the shadows began a song of such surpassing loveliness, and of such blinding power, that he listened perforce, and a blindness came upon him, as his eyes roamed to and fro, seeking her. All his court were cast down in slumber, and all the fires faded and were quenched, but the Silmarils in the crown on Morgoth's head blazed forth suddenly with a radiance of white flame, and the burden of that crown and of the jewels bowed down his head, as though the world were set upon it, laden with a weight of care, of fear, and of desire, that even the will of Morgoth could not support. Then Luthien, catching up her winged robe, sprang into the air, and her voice came dropping down like rain into pools, profound and dark. She cast her cloak before his eyes, and set upon him a dream, dark as the outer void where once he walked alone. Suddenly he fell, as a hill sliding an avalanche, and hurled like thunder from his throne, lay prone upon the floors of hell. The iron crown rolled echoing from his head. All things were still. Yet another wonderful, for a brief style time moment, another wonderful example of those little short, simple sentences with which Tolkien so often ends these dramatic paragraphs. All things were still. Okay. Lots to say about this. This is so good. Yes, Mike, as you say, and it stank, right? Yes, exactly that kind of sentence. That is speaking again of the fell beast, when Eowyn is about to lop its head off. Good. Okay. Now here, there's so many things that we can see here, and want to talk about. I want to talk about what she does to him, what we see of her spell and of the dream she lays upon him, how we see Morgoth, what actually overcomes Morgoth. But even before that, I want to look at Morgoth's own desire and this sort of very sinister sentence. Morgoth looking upon her beauty conceived in his thought an evil lust and a design more dark than any that had yet come into his heart since he fled from Valinor. So let's see, raise your hands if you want to talk about that. I know several of you do. John, I think you had wanted to talk about this too. So, John's not with us anymore. So, Joe, go ahead.
Alrighty. Well, I think that Melkor's plans are similar, as to how he made the orcs, and kind of parallel also to what, Sauron did with the Uruk-hai. We already know that, Ainur and an elf mixed together can have children, hence Luthien. So, it seems to me that Melkor, thinking of this, is seeking to make, another race, something super powerful, another mixture of elf and Ainur that would be really powerful. And I'm pretty sure that somewhere in the Silmarillion before it talks about one of his worst deeds being the twisting of the elves and
yes.
Making them into orcs possibly. And then this just would be so much worse. I mean, it just seems like this would just top everything, marring the most beautiful thing that has ever been made and turning it into something evil for him would just be awful.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard because on the one hand, one thing that I want to say, because this is a mistake that people often make, one always has to be careful with Tolkien, not to jump to conclusions about the word lust. Because, of course, the word lust means, has always meant desire. That is, in Middle English, the word lust means desire. It doesn't mean what we mean by lust. In Middle English, when one wants to say, crude and sinful sexual desire, they don't use the word lust. They use the word lechery. Lechery or even luxury, it was sometimes called. Lust was a much more generic term. It just meant desire, you want something. And very frequently we can see Tolkien using the word lust in that sense. For instance, he uses the word several times in that sense in The Hobbit. For instance, when he talks about the lust of the treasure, and the dragon lust that comes over people that has nothing to do with sex, that's just about the strong, overwhelmingly strong desire for gold, that the dragons feel and that the dwarves feel and that Bilbo even briefly is taken by. Most of the time, therefore, it's not sexual, certainly not necessarily sexual. But, here, I think we have more justification. He's looking upon her beauty and an evil lust is crossing his mind. And it does seem that he is desiring her. This is one of the few places, one of the few places in all of Tolkien's work where it seems that there genuinely is, a sexual overtone there. Joe, you have a great point, and that would be sort of emphasized by, Chris, I see that you were just going to say this, so I will give Chris Stevens credit for this, though I was just about to say it. Luthien herself is the daughter of Melian and Thingol, right? I mean, she is herself the child of Melian, of Amire and an elf. Joe, and you were mentioning this too. So, you know, yeah, why shouldn't he? As I think I've mentioned before, in the original versions, in the Book of Lost Tales, the Valar had kids. Well, it's not like all the time, but there were a bunch of people who were children, of the Valar. Many of the people, as I've cited before, Eonwë, for instance, who is introduced as the herald, he's one of the mightiest of the Maiar, who is the herald of Manwë, was originally the child of Manwë and Varda. He moved away from that, from the Valar having kids. They still have spouses, as we've talked about before, a long time ago, but they don't anymore have kids. And yet, Melian shows they can, in fact, reproduce with the children of Iluvatar. It's a little bit, more than a little bit horrifying. Dave, go ahead.
I was developing this thought off of something that Jason just said in the chat window, which is, the notion of Morgoth having offspring is kind of interesting. I suspect that he would have if that indeed was his concept, if that's something he even considered in imagining if he actually carried it out, I suspect that he would greatly regret it very quickly. Because, I imagine the offspring of Morgoth would probably become the single greatest threat to him. You know
right.
what I mean?
Right.
So that's a very interesting notion, Morgoth reproducing, and I have a feeling deep down that he wouldn't actually want to do it.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's certainly it's hard to imagine Morgoth being a good dad, and certainly would fear his children. And of course, there's lots of precedent for this kind of thing. Of course, one only has to briefly look at other mythologies to see, divine fathers who are always looking over their shoulders at their sons, especially, for instance, in Greek mythology all over the place. Morgoth wouldn't want to end up castrated and kicked out like so many others. I think that in the context of his desire, of his own malice and his own plan, I think that, the two things in the immediate context that we need to sort of look at, that is the way in which Tolkien contextualizes this evil plan, that immediately we see that it undoes him. He doesn't even get a chance to try an experiment. And Dave, I'm guessing you're right that most likely it would backfire on him were we able to carry it out. And the strongest evidence that we have for that is that it backfires on him before he even has a chance to carry it out. Like, while he's still thinking about it, it's backfiring on him. Because, and he is beguiled by his own malice, for he watched her, leaving her free for a while. So yes, its ultimate backfiring seems pretty safe. But Brandon, go ahead.
Yeah, I happen to disagree that this is some kind of innuendo of like sexual lust in some ways. I think it's more of a lust just for power over Iluvatar. He sees Morgoth, when he sees beauty, he conceives a design to use that beauty for power. Just remember that Morgoth himself was once a beautiful thing.
Right.
Fallen. So he sees himself in Luthien and ultimately Iluvatar and says, well, here's somehow I can get Iluvatar if I can get Luthien, maybe. Maybe that's his lust. Maybe it's not so as much sexual, you know?
Well, right. No, I mean, there's definitely a case for this, and I certainly think we have to be very careful about, even if we do see a sexual overlay to it, which I say I have a hard time avoiding in this scene, any kind of sexual implications of it. But I think we would be very much misunderstanding it if we looked at this merely as Morgoth sitting there saying, wow, I really have the hots for her. She's really cute. This is clearly not that. This is not, I mean, of course, the parallel here, as I think I mentioned this a couple weeks ago, we see several people who sort of suddenly see Luthien revealed in her beauty, and who sort of stand there, who become entranced and sort of stunned, by her beauty suddenly revealed. Beren, of course, in the woods, Celegorm and Curufin, when she meets with them in the woods, and Morgoth himself. So, You know, so we do have that parallel, but he's obviously very, very different from Baron in his response and the way that he's different, even to have the kind of reaction, a much more extreme reaction than Baron had, and to be making possessive statements about her and stuff, nothing like as far as Morgoth seems to be going here. And I guess, Brandon, where I would, sort of the extent to which I would go along with you there is to say, again, this is not just him having the hots for her. This is him seeing her as another, object of possession. It's already been established in this chapter that Luthien's parallel to the Silmarils themselves. That is, Thingol, her dad, was the first one to establish this parallel. That he values her, as much as, more than the Silmarils. And so he considers the Silmaril, a cheap price, for a bride price for Luthien. And I think that's sort of the first place that we see it. And then in the very Feanor sounding vow or, statement that Baron makes, we see that parallel sort of solidified. She is like the Silmarils. And we know what his reaction, what Morgoth's reaction is when he sees beautiful things. The other way, of course, that she's parallel with them. I mean, she's the most beautiful of all of the children of Iluvatar that ever was or ever will be. In as much as these creatures are desirable, in as much as they are beautiful, in as much as they are, Brandon, as you say, reflections of Iluvatar, himself, she is the ultimate example. The ultimate example of this kind. He saw the Silmarils, and they were the greatest work of craft that ever was or ever will be. They were the greatest sub-creation of any of the children of Iluvatar, and his response was lust, desire. He wanted them. He wanted to possess them and have them for himself, and he did. And now it would also be very natural, very like him anyway, to want to basically add Luthien to his collection. Now I've got the Silmarils and now I've got Luthien. I don't know what he wants to, like, keep her in a little cage off to the side. But I do think that there are some sexual implications here. I kind of doubt that we're not supposed to be thinking about that at all here. But I do think that it's important not to be thinking only about that, and not to be just thinking that, his thoughts are simply, those of, like, somebody watching porn or something. This is not just like the sort of a base lustful desire that he's having. It's more complicated than that. It's sort of a bigger part of his overall pattern. Mike, go ahead.
I think we see an echo of this dynamic in Grima, Wormtongue, and Eowyn in The Lord of the Rings.
Yes. That, of course, is another place where there is clearly a sort of sexual innuendo as well. Grima clearly does desire Eowyn, and with a kind of possessive desire that he sees her as, like, spoil that he is going to claim as his reward. She is the promised price, for his treachery. I think that we can see a parallel there, but again, even there, how to characterize the difference that I'm thinking of here? Grima's desire for Eowyn is wicked and possessive and certainly wholly disregarding her as a person or her own desires, and yet compared with Morgoth's possessiveness, it's almost humble. That is, she is the price for which he is going to do his treachery. Like, she is an end in some sense. Now, it's, again, I don't want to make it this, like, too romantic and, make Wormtongue into a tragic romantic hero here, but, which would be quite a bit of a stretch. But anyway, there's this sense in which there's something even cleaner, even though it's dirty and nasty. There's something, nevertheless, I think, by comparison, cleaner in Grima's desire, because at least, in a sense, she is an end that he desires rather than simply is just being absolutely all about him as it queries with Morgoth. He wants to, again, it seems to me, at the very least, he wants to possess her like he possesses the Silmaril, and his desire, in as much as he does desire her, is entirely greedy, is entirely self-focused, is entirely jealous and arrogant. But I don't know. I mean, I don't want to go too far as to say I hardly want to say that Grima's love for Eowyn is good or a redeeming thing. I don't think it is. But it strikes me as of a kind of a different quality. I guess there aren't too many people with whom you could compare Grima to make him look noble. But I guess, you know, Morgoth is sort of a logical candidate for that, if there is one. Good. Now, see, we should also talk about sort of the second part there, that is, about what she does to him. And what her spell is like. Let me reread that passage. Is on the top of 181. Then Luthien, catching up her winged robe, sprang into the air, and her voice came dropping down like rain into pools, profound and dark. She cast her cloak before his eyes and set upon him a dream, dark as the outer void where once he walked alone. And I think this is sort of another place where we see her associated with darkness, right? We've seen this before. We were commenting when in the first meeting with Beren how she's associated with shadow and darkness. You know, she of course not only literally has black hair, but is frequently associated with darkness. And it's this wonderful, at the very least, this wonderful irony that that Morgoth is outdone, is like outshadowed by Luthien. You know, this is in the depths of this, you know, the dark hell of Angband, at the center of the darkness, and yet it's with shadow that she overcomes him. As dark as the outer void where once he walked alone. And Mike, I think you had some comments that you wanted to make about the outer void.
Yeah, well, for me, the power of her spell comes from the fact that the spell is as dark as the outer void, and I get that okay, you know, it's a darkness of blackness that's as dark as anything could be in the story, which is the outer void. But for me, the true power comes from she's invoking the place and the circumstance and time where he began his story, where we're first introduced to him as a character and as a being, where he was in the outer void searching for the light imperishable. And Luthien's power is that she is able to conjure that point of origin, that point of where he began his journey, and that it's that energy and that power that puts him to sleep and puts him into the dream. Not the actual darkness as in lack of light, but the fact that she's conjuring where his story began.
Yeah, no, I would go one step further, Mike, and connect it back to the other observation that you made about Karkaroth. I think that we can see a similarity there. So if you think back in Morgoth's story, that time in the outer void where once he walked alone was, you know, you can look at it from a, you know, a glass half empty perspective and say that's where he started to go bad, right? It was his impatience of the emptiness of the void that first led him towards rebellion. But at the same time, you could look at it from a glass half full perspective and say two things. One, you know, that desire, his desire for life and for light was a good thing. The desire just as Aule says, when he's making his good speech to Iluvatar a couple chapters later, the desire for life, the desire for light, the desire for living things and for making things was placed into his heart by Iluvatar. It's his seeking after the imperishable flame is not a bad thing to do. Now, it becomes twisted, it becomes selfish, it becomes prideful, and therefore becomes evil. But it is not intrinsically bad. And I would also say, again, now back to the connection with her speech to Karkaroth, it was also, that is, that time when he was in the outer void, the last time he was happy, namely before he fell, before the music and before the discord. and before he became the wretched, self-consumed, and self-defeating entity that he has since become, he was briefly blessed and happy and beautiful and radiant. And, you know, so in a sense, like, you know, just as she's, you know, fall into dark oblivion and forget for a while the dreadful doom of life, that's what she says to Karkaroth. In a sense, she's saying almost exactly the same thing to Morgoth there. Fall into dark oblivion. Yeah, like the outer void. As you say, Mike, it doesn't get darker or more oblivious than that. And forget for a while the dreadful doom of life. Forget the misery that you have made for yourself. Forget all of your plans and all of your schemes and all of your pride and all of your self-seeking. And go back for a minute, recapture for a moment, you know, how things were in the void before that. And then he sleeps, he falls. And his own, you know, sort of desires undo them. I would go back then to how he is cast down in slumber, when the Silmarils blaze forth in a radiance of white flame, and the burden of that crown and of the jewels bowed down his head, as though the world were set upon it, laden with a weight of care, of fear, and of desire that even the will of Morgoth could not support. That is, his own desires, fear, his own care, the weight of the world which he has named unto himself. Remember when he descends into Arda, he says that he names it to himself and himself the master, and he names the Silmarils unto himself as well. the beauty of creation, he can't support it. He can't live with it. It is what the burden he has placed on himself, that he has tried to take up, is too much for him. And that's what weighs him down, and he falls. And it's like the sleep that he is placed into, like with Karkaroth, is almost like a brief release from that. Mike, did you want to add something there?
No, just briefly. I think that there is the aspect of pity and compassion from Luthien's perspective, and she recognizes where his story began. I was just thinking of, to take a completely different example, Citizen Kane and Charles Foster Kane, and at the end of the movie where he remembers the little sled and the happiness he felt as a character before everything went totally wrong. And so it's the same kind of concept as far as I'm concerned. She's not invoking his childhood because he wasn't ever a child, but
right.
there was a pureness and a time in his being where he wasn't corrupted, and she's taking him back to that.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, I think that it's really neat to see how that all fits together. Dave, go ahead.
I had two comments. One, I wanted to know if, I'll do the other comment first. I hadn't ever thought about, I don't think, maybe I've just never read Luthien's song very closely, but I hadn't ever made the connection that you just did. And now I see, in a way, Morgoth, you know, she's sort of playing on, it reminds me, well, I'm really stumbling all over myself. It reminds me of, when Fingolfin challenges Morgoth, and we see that Morgoth alone of the Valar feels fear. And this sort of harkens back to that, in that because he has tried to set himself up as master of the world, he has essentially made himself vulnerable in this way. You're sort of pointing this out, that he, in trying to make himself master of the world, he takes upon himself cares, worries, fears, burdens, and she's able to play off of that. And that, you know, that this sort of, oh God, I'm going to make a Harry Potter connection. this reminds me of how Harry, you know, Dumbledore states that, you know, tells Harry that, tyrants always create enemies in the folks that they oppress. And in this is sort of similar. Morgoth has made himself vulnerable to Luthien's song because of his desire and his to dominate others and to be a master. And then on top of that, I just wanted to connect this to Sauron's song against Felagund, that ultimately the victory or the efficacy of the song is the fact that the other person has made a choice or committed an act that creates vulnerability. So Sauron wins because he sings about the horrible atrocities that the Noldor committed. Luthien is able to conquer Morgoth here because of the sort of, you know, the vulnerability that he's introduced in the evil desires that he has.
I agree. And I think that, you know, we can definitely see that vulnerability, and it is his own choices that bring him down. And it is, as we say, this is sort of not something that, should be surprised by at this point. But yeah, and I think, you know, that seeing their sort of, this sort of symmetrical, thing with, you know, as I was talking about his desire for Luthien being compared to his desire for the Silmarils. And here we see those two things are the three things that we see him lusting after: Luthien, the Silmarils, and Arda itself. Those are the things which are weighing him down and which bring him, which ultimately bring him down, in this moment, which is sort of a foreshadowing of his ultimate bringing down, which is going to happen later on. Let's see. I want to move along. We've only got about 20 minutes or so left, and I definitely want to get to the ending stuff. So that means we're going to have to be sort of move swiftly by a couple things. But one last thing I wanted to hit on, Nick, if you are around, you made a really interesting point, about, Baron going beyond his oath and, moving to get the other Silmarils. Are you available to talk about that?
Yeah, I just wanted to make a general comment on how pride often leaves a character to downfall in Tolkien. Beren goes beyond his oath and reaches for another Silmaril, and this is enough to supersede the power of the Song of Luthien, which enabled the fulfillment of the oath in the first place. And it got me to thinking that it seems that oaths, I don't want to bring it back to oaths, maybe I do, but it seems that oaths, even though they may often be created in a positive manner, such as Beren's to Thingol, they seem to often lead to misery, more often than not, through the process of unfolding. At the same time, songs seem to usually give hope or issue in you catastrophic moments, though not always. So I guess just a general comment on the link between oaths and discatastrophe and song and you catastrophe.
Yeah, oh, that's neat. That's neat. And it certainly is, you're right that it's sort of an interesting thing that it's not the fulfillment of the oath. Remembering Finrod's words, and thus we are all ensnared. Beren is not ensnared in tragedy, at this moment. That is, it's not leading to his destruction, the oath, at this moment. What gets him into trouble is going beyond the oath. As you say, that's clearly sort of an act of pride, like, hey, I could come out with all three Silmarils, wouldn't that be awesome? Not content with what has apparently been given to him here. And I say given because it seems increasingly clear that this is destiny. We've seen this from the beginning. You know, the strong fate that is laid upon Beren so that he gets past the Girdle of Melian from the beginning. We know that there is a strong fate, a strong doom laid upon him. It is his doom, and we have seen events conspire to help them and to bring about this moment. So when he seeks to go beyond this, he's going beyond his fate. It is his fate to take one of the Silmarils from the Iron Crown, not his fate to take all three. And I think, you know, you're right. His action and his action there certainly does almost undo the great accomplishment of Luthien's song there. Laura, go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to point out too that when Varda hallowed the Silmarils originally, part of that was that no mortal hand could touch the Silmarils without being scorched and withered. But that seems to be put aside for Beren. He's allowed to touch them without being scorched. And I thought that could mean, you know, the Valar may have a bit more of a hand in this than we see from just, you know, external circumstances. How else could Beren be able to touch the Silmaril without being burned?
Yeah, it certainly is at the very least a pretty strong endorsement of Beren here, right? That this is clearly what that this is clearly a good thing. Of course, we will see the flip side of this later on. When finally a couple Sons of Feanor do get their hands on Silmarils, they're going to get scorched by them. So we can see, yeah, there's clearly the difference. You know, we were sort of looking at some of the similarities in the thing that Beren said and the Oath of Feanor, but clearly in the end, big differences between their attitudes and especially their attitudes towards the Silmarils. But yeah, I think that there we can certainly see a sort of, you know, Valar stamp of approval on Beren here at the very least. He is clearly, he is being protected. Okay. One quick question, before we move on to the final section, that is, to Luthien's performance before Mandos. That is, what about Thingol when they return? What exactly makes Thingol change his mind? What are your thoughts on this? Why does Thingol relent? As I know, a lot of people were, you guys have not been big fans of Thingol all the way through, and there's a lot of harshing on Thingol a couple weeks ago when we were looking at that section. Why does he turn around here? Joe?
Alright. Well, it seems to me that, like, one reason kind of is like a Baron's honesty and self-sacrifice and humility when he returns. You know, Thingol didn't expect Beren to come back or live through it or touch a Silmaril or do any of that. You know, granted, when he comes back, he's missing a Silmaril, but he comes back alive with, you know, kind of the proof missing the hand, and also with Thingol's daughter, who was willing to go to the death just to stay with Beren, which is, like, a big point in itself. And I also kind of think that since Thingol sensed something that larger was happening, that he couldn't stop, which could either be a curse of the Noldor or the will of Iluvatar. I'm thinking it's the second one. Right. I'm not sure which one, but he just thought it best to kind of go with the flow, so he just kind of sensed something larger going, and he got over himself, which is kind of hard to do because he's so tall. Yes, that was a joke.
Yeah, no, you're right. Sense that something bigger is going on. That's exactly one of the mistakes, anyway, that he made at the beginning. He wasn't sort of realizing what this meant, even though, you know, his immensely wise wife was giving him heavy hints. Nevertheless, he wasn't getting the fact that this is a big deal. This is a high destiny. You know, when he's saying, "Who are you, baseborn mortal?" You know, to lay claim to Luthien. Well, yeah, look, who he is this guy with his really high destiny. This is, you know, as your wife was trying to tell you, this is part of the big story, man. And he's not seeing it. And now he's sort of recognizing, oh, okay, yeah, I think that, now I see that this is kind of a big point. And that he realizes that he's just been kind of missing the boat. So I do think that that's definitely part of it. Dave?
Just one word, pity.
Hmm.
I had to say that for Laura because she's got the little red line icon next to her, which means she's away. So I think the main driving thing is pity. He sees how much suffering they've been through, and it finally, you know, breaks him. And of course, that is a very strong recurring theme throughout all of Tolkien. So
yeah.
But, anyway, I'm going to stop talking because I really want to hurry on to Juan's death.
Yeah, definitely. No, exactly. And I think that, pity is because it's when Beren holds out the stump of his arm and, you know, and is like, my hand, it's not there. It's not like Beren doesn't realize it, but the way that that's dramatized, yeah, that's the moment. That's what we're told is the moment when Thingol does have pity on him. So yeah, I think that's a pretty good thing. I will say we've not done a lot of complimenting of Thingol in this seminar so far, but that does seem to be a pretty good thing for him. Chris?
Just real quick, I think going along with what everybody else said, plus I think he held men, humans, in such low regard always. I mean, he had no use for them, didn't want them around. I don't think he, you know, had any regard for them at all. And to just contemplating what everything that he had done, and again, in addition to the pity and some of the other things that have already been said, he thought, well, I think he discovered, well, maybe these are, I haven't given these creatures enough credit all along. Maybe I need to pay more attention to them.
Yeah. Yeah. Good. And that's certainly we will see in the following chapters that will be true of him. This is not just, hey, okay, this Baron guy is kind of cooler than I thought he was, but that it is going to be changing his attitude towards humans in general is going to be changing as a consequence of this. So I agree. I think that's an important thing to point out. Matt?
Yes, I was just going to say that I think it's one of the greatest ironies of all that we've encountered so far that Thingol refers to Baron as a mortal and a baseborn mortal, like a curse or a taunt. And then ultimately, his own daughter chooses mortality to be with Baron.
Yeah, exactly. Now, it's not, I think, you know, he doesn't, I think, anticipate that yet. He doesn't see that that's happening or that that's coming exactly, I think. But yeah, I mean, certainly, it is a really pronounced irony that he, of all people, should, he is going to have cause to regret that, that way of thinking, pretty soon. And this also kind of leads us, points us, like, nudges us again towards our return, promised, foretold by Brandon to the, release from bondage. Okay. I have to give you a chance. Any quick thoughts on the death of Huan before we move to the deaths and resurrections? Anyone? Death of Huan fulfills his destiny. Okay, Dave, I knew you had something on Huan.
Well, my comment's mostly trivial. I just wanted to point out, I guess they were right.
Darned if that prophecy didn't turn out to be accurate.
Yes. It is pretty tragic, though, and of course you sort of knew. I mean, maybe we should have known this. The prophecy doesn't say anything about why he would die or how he would go out, other than who he would be killed by. But of course, he's going to die committing an act of self-sacrifice. I mean, that's totally consistent with who he is.
Yeah, and I think it's. And he's say, you know, and of course, I mean, you know, how do you know you're in the middle of like a group of good guys? Well, like when everyone's throwing themselves in front of danger for the sake of other people, right? I mean, Baron got wounded by throwing himself in front of Thingol. Baron has been kind of making a living, but that would be an ironic thing to say under the circumstances, has been nearly dying multiple times by throwing himself, in front of, you know, between the Thingol family and death. But yes, and then Huan sort of takes it all upon himself and is the one who finally defeats, you know, one of the greatest, and I think it's easy to overlook, you know, Glaurung is going to get a lot of press later on. He's going to be, you know, of course, this huge monstrous figure who's going to ruin a lot of Beleriand single-handedly, but Karkaroth, we're told, is one of the great, this is one of the great dangers that has ever faced Beleriand. Karkaroth was already, a really powerful monstrous creature, and now he is, to some extent, invested with the power of the Silmaril, and this is kind of a big. So Huan is really accomplishing something. Laura?
Yeah, I just wanted to point out, even though the prophecy was fulfilled, it wasn't really fulfilled in the way you think it's going to be. You know, when we get to Angband and we see Karkaroth, we think, oh, this is the end of Huan, but it doesn't happen until much later in a way that especially Morgoth would not have foreseen. So it does fulfill the prophecy, but it's not exactly like what you think it's going to be.
Right, exactly. And that's accentuated by the fact when Sauron tries to make the prophecy come true. And that's, again, at like a guarding the gate moment, right? I'm going to take the form of this huge monstrous wolf and I'm going to fight Huan right there on the bridge at the gates of my tower. And that doesn't work out. So that does sort of prime us when we see Karkaroth now guarding this other set of gates to this even stronger fortress, that this is going to be the moment when Huan does his thing. But as you say, no, that's not the moment. It's a different moment, and in many ways it's sort of a more beautiful moment. But okay. We have at least 7 minutes, to talk about Luthien's song, Baron's death, Luthien's song, and their return to life. Laura, I want to start with your point, because I think it's, I wanted to talk about that too. Your comment about Orpheus. It was interesting. We started 2 weeks ago talking about Rapunzel, which is clearly a story which, you know, sort of associated with which, you know, which it's hard to avoid when we're thinking about Luthien letting down her hair to escape from her up the tree prison. And now at the end, certainly we are at least as compelled, I think, to remember the myth of Orpheus. Laura, would you be willing to do a little Orpheus summary for us, for the sake of people who are not immediately familiar to remember the details of the Orpheus story? Can you do that, or would you want me to do it?
You know, really the only thing I really know about the Orpheus story is that he goes to the underworld to try to reclaim his lover.
Yes.
And that's pretty much the only thing I know, so you might want to give a little summary.
Yeah, well, it is a tragic death. I mean, the sort of the classical story, and here I'm leaning mostly on Ovid's version of the story. Orpheus and his wife Eurydice, well, his almost wife, that's sort of the tragedy, and his lover Eurydice, they're getting married. And on their wedding day, like during the ceremony, she accidentally treads on a snake which bites her in the heel, and she dies on their wedding day, and it's really sad and it's really tragic. And Orpheus is the greatest musician that has ever lived or will ever live, and he descends down to the underworld and he plays a song of sorrow before Hades, before Pluto, the god of the underworld, and he moves the god of the underworld to pity for the first and only time, and he says, you can take her back up, but he places this stipulation upon the return with Eurydice to the overworld, and that is, she will follow along behind him, but he can't look back at her before they get up to the top. And right before they get up into the overworld, they're just about home free, and he can't resist turning and looking behind him, and he turns and looks behind at her, and he sees her right there behind him, about to emerge back into life and reunion with him, but as he turns back, she is snatched back away, and he has no further chance, and he spends the rest of his life wandering miserably until eventually he is dismembered and torn into pieces. So that's the Orpheus and Eurydice story, and it's obvious to see the parallels here. Again, this is something that that doesn't really take any effort to see. You've got you know, the parallel of the singer. Luthien is one of the most powerful singers, like Orpheus. You have it's in this case it's not like a descent down into the underworld, but she goes to the underworld herself, sings before Mandos isn't exactly the god of the underworld, but he's the closest thing we have in this mythology. Move to pity for the first and only time. So clearly we have some strong parallels, but there are also some really important differences. And I think it is, Laura, as you said, sort of a twist or a retelling of the myth of Orpheus, which is different in several important ways. Laura, you had some follow-up thoughts on that?
Yeah, what got me thinking about it was actually Sir Orfeo, the medieval romance.
Yes. Yes.
That you talk about, fairy and fantasy, and that's what got me thinking on that track in the first place. And also, I just wanted to bring up Nienna when Luthien is crying in front of Mandos. It just made me think of Nienna with her tears watering the trees, and you know, the power of that kind of pity, that's the sort of thing that Nienna exhibits, and Luthien is putting it to good use here.
Yes, yes. I mean, and that's, we should read that bit, because you're right, we should be thinking of Nienna, I think, for several reasons. It's the very bottom of 186, top of 187, it's the fourth to last paragraph in the chapter. The song of Luthien before Mandos was the song most fair that ever in words was woven, and the song most sorrowful that ever the world shall hear. Unchanged, imperishable, it is sung still in Valinor beyond the hearing of the world, and listening, the Valar are grieved. For Luthien wove two themes of words, of the sorrow of the Eldar and of the grief of men, of the two kindreds that were made by Iluvatar to dwell in Arda, the kingdom of Earth, amid the innumerable stars. And as she knelt before him, her tears fell upon his feet like rain upon the stones, and Mandos was moved to pity, who never before was so moved, nor has been since. Certainly that image of her dropping her tears like rain upon the stones, certainly should make us think of Nienna. But also, Luthien wove two themes of words is also kind of a cue to us as well, right? This begins to sound inescapably Aina Lindelay-like, and when we are remembering the Aina Lindelay and hearing her song, what should we be thinking of? What does her song sound like? Anybody? Yes, yes. Hey, Jason, do you have your microphone? Say it aloud.
The third theme?
Exactly. Which we will remember is tremendously sad, but it is from its sorrow that its beauty chiefly comes. And I think that clearly that's what we should be thinking of here. And I think it's important also, Luthien moves Mandos, not just because she's saying, see, like, I'm really sad and I've gotten a really, like, you know, I've had this bum deal in my life and like things have gone really, like, it's, my life has ended really tragically. That's not her song. Her song is about the sorrow of the two kindreds. She is, in this sense, a foreshadowing of Eärendil, right? She is sort of the first emissary of the two kindreds together over here. But what she's doing is sort of even wider scope, than what Eärendil will eventually do. Not just, you know, elves and men are kind of getting pounded on by Morgoth over here, but these are the sorrows of the two kindreds. You know, the two griefs, the sorrow of the Eldar and the grief of men. And I think we can even see a distinction, between those two things. But, anyway, so I think that, Brandon, go ahead.
I was just gonna ask, what about the triumph over death? And just kind of like, you know, in this story we have so many releases of bondage. You know, I was just going through and counting and I counted six. You know, you have Beren's literal release, Ulan's release from bondage, the release of the people of Narathon, the prisoners of Sauron, Luthien from her tree, and so on and so forth. But I think the biggest one is the release of the bondage of life and death, and through love and through sorrow and beauty, you know? I think that's probably where the title comes from. I don't know. Thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, that's the, you know, it's hard not to see that as being the, although as we say, you know, we were noticing from the beginning, there's a whole lot of, you know, different kinds of bondage and escape and imprisonments and things. People getting imprisoned. There's so many jailbreaks throughout this chapter, all this stuff. But clearly the culmination of the release from bondage does seem to be very much the end. I mean, ultimately the Beren and Luthien story is not even about the thing that they accomplish, the heroic thing they accomplish, which is more heroic and more impressive than anything accomplished by anybody else at any point. I mean, this deed of Beren and Luthien is the most famous deed that will ever be accomplished. But that's not even really the point, the ultimate point of their story. Their bond to each other. Because remember, the other bondage imagery that we got was not just the negative stuff of people being imprisoned, but even the positive thing. Beren's love for Luthien when the spell of enchantment was laid upon him was also characterized as a bond, and as a chain even. and yet that bond, the bond of them together, is unbroken. And that bond is what leads them to be ultimately set free, in a sense, set free from tragedy. Their story, from their perspective, is not tragic in the end. They are reunited and they're not gonna be separated. This, remember, as Tolkien emphasizes in The Lord of the Rings, this is why, to Elrond, it's a really, really, really big deal that his daughter is marrying a mortal, because unlike Thingol, he has a precedent for this and he knows what it means. Thingol doesn't really understand what it means. He just sees this as this mad presumption on the part of a mortal. But Elrond, because this is the post-Luthien era, knows exactly what it means, and therefore knows that, as Tolkien says in The Lord of the Rings, towards the end of Many Partings, that their separation is going to endure beyond the world. I mean, it's like not until the end of time is there any chance of Arwen and Elrond being able to get together again. Whereas, as we know, as we've seen and talked about before, elves do get reunited. Earlier in this chapter, we're told that Finrod is reunited with his dad, Finarfin, whom he left behind in Valinor after his death. But there's gonna be no such reunion, for Luthien and her dad or any of the other elves. But no separation between her and Beren. She and Beren would have been separated permanently, well, at least until the end of the world, had their fates remained as they originally were. So their bond together frees them from separation. And so it's interesting, because ultimately the story of Beren and Luthien is a tragedy, but a tragedy from whose perspective? I mean, if you look at the very, and I think the very end of this chapter is, and I think we mentioned this in previous weeks too, one of the most obviously and explicitly elf-centric statements of the entire book, of this entire book, which is elf-centric, as we've talked about at many points before. The last sentence, yet in her choice the two kindreds have been joined, and she is the forerunner of many in whom the Eldar see yet, though all the world is changed, the likeness of Luthien the Beloved, whom they have lost. They have lost her. That's their tragedy. They won't get Luthien. And this, of course, is also another reason why it hurts more for Elrond and for others that Arwen is gonna be Luthien part two, both, you know, in her destiny, because what we're told that people were saying about Arwen, Elrond's daughter, is that she's like Luthien come again. She's, you know, she reminds the people who remember Luthien, and there are people kicking around who knew Luthien personally. Not Elrond, of course, as he is a descendant of hers, but there are others who do. Arwen reminds her of Luthien. She's almost like Luthien come again, and now darn it if she isn't going to do the same thing and they're going to lose her just like they lost Luthien the first time. But anyway, digressing. Or yes, Laura, as you say, Galadriel and Círdan both clearly. Galadriel, obviously, she lived with Luthien for centuries. Círdan, certainly. Celeborn too. Celeborn was her kinsman, there in Doriath. Yeah, Chris, go ahead.
I had a thought, thinking about the nature of death being from the perspective of being the gift of Iluvatar to men, and then on a kind of a parallel thought that somewhere early in the book it said something about even the Valar and the Eldar may become weary of being in Arda as time passes. So it almost seems to me like from thinking about the bondage from the point that Arda is really in the grand scheme of things through the end of, you know, when you look at that through the whole length of time, Arda is just kind of temporary. It's going to end, and presumably everybody's going to be with Iluvatar in some sense down the road. Well, Luthien gets to join Beren and go to Iluvatar ahead of time. Mm-hmm. I mean, with the men. So that's, again, the nature of the gift of men being a very positive thing, being able to leave the world and go to be with Iluvatar. So I guess that's a thought I had as I read that.
Yeah. No, I agree with you. I agree with you in a kind of slightly qualified way. That is, it is certainly true. And you're right to remember those passages. We know that the Valar are bound. They're tied now to Arda, having entered it. And as you say, you rightly quote that passage from before where, that the release from Arda in death that men get is something which in that one sentence is even the powers might envy. It is going to be kind of wearying eventually, to still be bound here. But here's my qualification. I think that we have to be careful. The sort of the knee-jerk temptation when comparing the fates of elves and men is to say, oh, look, elves have it well and men get the shaft. You know, elves are immortal and men are mortal, and this is really sad, and obviously elves get what's best. But then you sort of look at it and you think about, you know, Chris, exactly as you say, the gift of Iluvatar and all that, and you say, actually, you know, and so one can easily talk oneself around to completely the other direction and saying, actually, death is awesome, men have it good, and elves are getting the shaft, and the gift of men is far superior to the gift that elves have, and I think that's not, that's clearly no more true than the other one is. So I agree.
So, as I say,
I think we have to be careful. I would resist reading the end of this in such a way that we sort of say, like, ultimately we see that the real blessing, the real release is through death and to be set free from the world. I think that is an element here. It is definitely sort of involved. But anyway, I think it's to say it in that way, not, Chris, not that you were saying it as crudely as I was saying it, but to put it in that way would be kind of an oversimplification of the situation, I think. I mean, it's kind of, there's so many ironies in some ways in the end, you know, the irony that their bond to each other and the chain of love that is laid upon Beren at the beginning ultimately sort of is their freedom. The irony of, you know, the two of them being freed by their fate, like they are constrained to pursue their destiny, but then their destiny is what, you know, the destiny that they are constrained to pursue, you know, sort of frees them from, you know, ultimately from their situation, you know, frees them from tragedy so that they themselves don't have a tragic end. Well, there's lots more to say about this here, but we have reached our time. We started a little bit late, so I indulged myself to go to 2 hours from our starting point, but we should probably end. And if anyone has anything that you want to bring back about especially the release from bondage stuff, we can kind of come back with that a little bit at the beginning of next time. But next time we're doing the Nir-Naeth Arnoidiad, which is clearly tragic. So we'll have lots of depressing things to talk about next time. Any final thoughts, comments before we sign off here? Yeah, Brandon, go ahead.
Just want to say oaths are a good thing, and good night.
All right. Yes, I was.
Well done, Brandon.
Okay. Thanks to everybody again. And we will say goodnight.
I hope you all enjoyed our 3-part discussion of Beren and Luthien. That chapter always strikes me deeply, and currently I'm planning to have some passage from it or from the Lay of Lathian read at my wedding next year. Yes, on a personal note, I finally proposed to my own long-suffering Luthien. I'd love to hear your thoughts about which part exactly I should use. Please share them with me on the Silmarillionaires Facebook page, or tweet them at my Twitter handle, Dave Kale, DaveKale, or at the official Silmarillionaires Twitter account, Silmarillionaire spelled without an E. I have some additional announcements. First, I'd like to point you to a listener's blog called Iceberg Inc. at icebergink.blogspot.ca. Over the next year, the author Scott is going to work his way through the Silmarillion, I believe for the first time ever, aided by our podcast. Should make for good reading. Second, although we have not publicized it widely, some of the Silmarillionaires are currently conducting a second seminar during which we are working our way through both primary sources such as the histories of Middle-earth, as well as published Silmarillion scholarship and other secondary sources. While recordings won't be available for download for a while, if you'd like to listen in live, we usually broadcast on Middle-earth Network Radio every other Thursday night. Stay tuned to our Facebook page for announcements. Further, we may soon have room for additional participants if you're interested. Finally, if you're not listening to the Mythgard Institute's Riddles in the Dark podcast featuring Professor Olsen and myself, then you must not be excited about The Hobbit, which I find hard to believe. So, go visit the Mythgard website immediately and find out more about this awesome podcast in which you'll hear the very best Hobbit analysis and speculation available on the internet.
Thanks for listening, and Godspeed.